quick roll call.
Scott Hamburger. Ashburn.
Cliff Pierce, Broadway.
Don Walker, Catoctin.
John Whitbeck at large. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from the March 5th, 2013 meeting?
What's moved? A couple corrections, just other than for the participants, my name was spelled under review, and next steps.
Gotcha. We will correct that.
Any other changes? All right. The moved. Did I get a second to that?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Unanimous. Review of county supplements.
Did you all receive the chart that we distributed?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if everyone has a copy. Does everyone have a copy? Did anyone else have a chance to look at it? Okay. If I may.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
My only comment in looking at it is that I don't see any material difference between the range of salaries that are paid to those employees who have no subsidy compared to the employees who do have subsidy. In some cases, you know, if you look, for example, probation officers, those who have a subsidy have an average salary of $52,000. Whereas those who are employed by the county have an average salary of $62,000. However, when you look at the dates of hire of the county mix of county employees, they in general seem to have more seniority than the comparable employees who are getting a supplement from the state. Therefore, it occurs to me, and perhaps someone can correct me if I'm wrong, it occurs to me that the average salary is probably higher for that pool of people based on seniority, as opposed to anything else.
That would be
the correct inference. Okay. So I think that we requested the information in order to analyze whether there was any discrepancy and whether there were overpayments of folks who were receiving a portion of compensation from the state compared to those who do not receive a supplement or a portion of salary from the state. I don't see a discrepancy there. Is anyone else?
Is there only way you could directly compare is if there's sort of a entry level starting salary for a position. Sometimes even that can vary depending on, typically in government service, you come in for a certain job, you're going to start at this pay grade, and that's your entry level pay. If that was something comparable, that way you could take out, is it really based on the number of years of work? If you can look at what is the entry level pay when somebody comes in, if there's a discrepancy there.
Right.
Mr. Sherrill, if I may.
Please.
Even if you could do that, certainly in the county system and also in the state system, there is the ability to bring someone in at a percentage higher than the absolute minimum based on education and experience. Okay. So you'd still have that factor. There's no way to 100%
equalize. So a lot of federal government doesn't matter. When you come in at this pay grade and this step, and that's all there is to it.
So, in my view, I think we've looked at the data, and I don't see anything to be drawn from it that's indicative of a problem.
Anyone have anything else?
I think since it's just been recently provided, like yesterday, we should allocate a little bit more time to it.
If you would like to spend some more time on it, feel free. I had a chance to look at it for about 30 minutes or so this afternoon, so I don't personally think there's any more to be mined from it. But I defer to the chair.
I don't have any problem with putting it on the agenda for next time.
For the 23rd. for the full commission agenda?
I don't really control that agenda. That's more for Tom.
Okay, for the next subcommittee agenda?
I don't have a problem with putting on the next agenda, but what do you want to do with it? You want
a chance to review it a little further, study it a little more.
Okay. Well, it's only on the agenda here for review, so if you... Why don't we do this? Why don't we just put it under... I guess we don't really have old business, but if there's something you find that you want to bring up, we can certainly add to the agenda at that time. But otherwise, you know, you may find there's nothing there, and let's not make an agenda item unless we have to. Does that work?
Agreed.
Okay. Does that work?
Of course, you may.
Review of county fees. Do you have another?
Do I have any comments? Shockingly, yes. I did have a chance to look at the Board of Supervisors item from July of 2012. So one thing that struck me was we've been asked to look at something that appears to have been looked at in pretty recently. So is there any background on this particular item that we should know, George, and how this item might relate to the request that we were given from the board?
In terms of background, I believe at the time, a year ago, less than a year ago, again, this board is fairly new in office. I think on a couple of occasions there have been questions in different forums related to fees of the Parks and Rec and Community Services Department. In the Finance Committee, Mr. Bona asked for a comprehensive item related to fees of that department. That's what generated this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's necessarily any relation between this and the board's request of this committee, other than the adult daycare fee program, as you know, came up as a specific separate issue. Mrs. Wyburn is here. I don't know if you would like to add anything to that background to this.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Wyburn.
How are you doing?
Very well. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Thanks for spending so much time with us.
As Julie said, we are still working on the adult day item, and we'll be continuing to work on that. The item here that you have before you that the Finance Committee looked at basically outlines the percentage of recovery, or some would say over-recovery, and that's based on the direct operating costs. So, for example, the CASA program. And by direct operating costs, typically we talk about the staff time, the materials and supplies associated with the program. So, for example, the CASA program, the budgeted amount of recovery is 116%. Preschool is 115%, summer camps 107%. And child care 105%. The instructor program, we go between 120% and 135%. And then the rec center by board policy is supposed to be 100%. So we try very hard to meet that 100% at the rec center. It's running between 94% and 96% right now. It's something we track weekly. With the instructional programs, basically some of those programs are taught by our instructors and many of them are contracted out. So we do contract out for instructional programs, for example, Zumba and some of those other things. The fees along for the last several years, we have increased fees. Oftentimes the board is looking for us to lower our tax rate and so thus we increase the fees. So I'm not sure if the committee has any specific questions, but we've been pretty good at meeting these percentages and often exceeding these percentages.
Well, the only other thing I would like to add, because I've heard it brought up on a couple of occasions here and in the boardroom, to be honest, it was mentioned that some of the programs in Parks and Recreation are intended for low-income residents. I'm not sure of how the origin of all these programs, but I do know that at least over the last 20 years, that has not been the case. That has never been the primary intent. It was more a question of offering, in the case of child care, for example, offering a service in a section of the county or geographic area of the county where that service was plainly and simply not offered. Child care in Lovettsville, for example. So that's just an example.
Yeah. Do you have a question?
Just to make sure I understood Julie's point, it is not a stated mission of these plans to provide services for a certain level of income.
Correct.
It is to provide a service, make it available, period. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
But I would like to add that, unfortunately, because of the policy, sometimes the lower income children do get left out. Years ago, there was a study done to find out, at that time we had a sliding fee scale for the after-school program, and it was determined that the participants or the families could get a better subsidy through working with the Department of Social Services than us providing the sliding fee scale. So at that time we eliminated the sliding fee scale and then partnered with Family Services. So some of the participants do get assistance from Family Services, the low income. But there is a group of people that kind of, you know, with the waiting list at Social Services, they don't make enough to be able to afford the CASA program. So there are some kids that are probably not getting served. But I think we've done pretty well along the way at continually increasing the fees in order to meet the recovery guidelines.
When I looked at the pricing and the comparables to different jurisdictions, and frankly, I was a little lost at the spreadsheet at the end, the benchmarking attachment 4, but we'll come back to it in a minute. When I looked at the pricing compared to comparable jurisdictions, and I recognized there are some challenges in making sure you're comparing apples to apples,
right.
But you know, our pricing seems to be kind of all over the map. Sometimes we are a lot higher than comparable jurisdictions, sometimes we're a lot lower,
yes.
Sometimes we're in the same range. Is there a logic there that is not apparent, or is it really driven by the recovery schedule? You know, are you pricing to the recovery schedule because that's the direction that you're given, and that really dictates the pricing, or are you pricing based on any kind of analysis of what the market will bear or what comparable rates are in other areas?
I would say it's a combination of those. For example, in our rental rates, the prices are sometimes lower, but they at times, or higher in some cases, and at times people will just not rent. I think that's probably the one that changes the most. In terms of the recreation center, I think we are pretty much in line with what others are doing. But it does vary according to the demand for services. The adult sports league fee, for example, that is required to be 100% revenue neutral and to cover the cost of the 2 sports specialists and 90% of the sports coordinators. So some of them by board policy are very specific as to what the fee needs to be in order to meet the policy. But some of them are based on market rate. If that helps. And then some of them are pretty much dependent on the cost, like the instructor program. Our goal is to offer a variety of instructional programs, those that are on the lower end, and so you would get a less qualified instructor, then your fee would be lower, and then you have people who want, you know, the expert level. So those classes would be higher because you're hiring a higher level of instruction.
And essentially it's a cost plus pricing model.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, it's said in business a lot, you get what you measure. You know, whenever you say, I want to measure that, you get more of that. And it seems to me as if the board has given you certain guidelines as to what has to be recovered, and then everything follows from that. You know, they're getting what they're asking for, and it seems to me that drives a lot of your pricing decisions.
Yes, it does.
If you took a more market-based approach, you know, do you think that you would change your, if you had to be profit-driven, just for the sake of argument,
mm-hmm.
And you took a more market-based approach to your pricing program, do you think that you could charge more for a lot of things that you do?
Based on the market, in some cases I think we could, and in some cases I don't think we could. I think in some cases, for example, the summer camp program. We have a wildly popular summer camp program with, you know, registration day. Many of the programs were filled. But I would like to say that I think we have quality programs, and I think people seek our programs because they do have a good reputation and because of our staffing. So in some areas, I do think that some of the market could handle an increase, but there's many people that cannot handle an increase. So you have to balance that in terms of, are we trying to, you know, our mission, I think, is to serve all of the county, not just those that can afford it. So I kind of struggle with that piece from time to time, because some of the kids that can afford the programs are the kids that really need to be in the programs. Mm-hmm. So we do have that. I think it would be wonderful if there was a foundation out there, and one year we did have the Claude Moore Foundation that did pay for scholarships, and so a lot of those kids were able to get into the CASA program and the summer camp program. Mm-hmm.
But a one-size-fits-all pricing program is a bit of a challenge, right? Because if you try to make the pricing program fit a certain level and below in terms of what's affordable, then there's a tremendous amount of cost recovery that's being left on the table. You know, that so essentially at that point, taxpayers are not recovering from those who could pay for it. So, you know, I just wonder if it's not two separate questions. You know, the cost of tuition is what it is.
Right.
You then either qualify for aid or merit-based scholarships or whatever you qualify for, or you don't. But the cost is the cost. So,
right.
You know, I wonder if an approach, rather than saying, you know, we need to price it so that it's affordable for the neediest, you know, maybe the answer is we need to price it. We need to price it the right price, you know, whatever the market price is. And then if there are instances when a needy individual cannot afford to do it, then we need to address that, you know, with some kind of assistance.
And that's the part we don't have right now, mm-hmm. is the mechanism to address those that need it and can't afford it.
And of
that's
course,
my concern.
And of course, the people who are paying the full freight are frequently subsidizing those who can't. So if you had a pricing structure,
I'm confused. I don't understand.
let's say you're charging $100 for something now, right?
Yes. Yes.
And let's say that the market would bear 120, and there are some people who could only pay 80.
Right.
If you charge the people who can pay 120 the extra $20, then those $20 would be available within the program to fund the people who could only afford to pay 80.
Right.
So my point being that, this is just kind of a philosophical discussion. My point being that it seems to me the price of the program ought to be the correct price for the program, and then to the degree that there are those who can't afford it, that should be addressed separately from trying to price the program to make it inherently affordable. Because if you price the program to make it inherently affordable, you're then missing all the marginal revenue that you could have gotten from the people who'd be more than willing to pay for it. Because it's a good program, as
you said. I understand.
And I guess that dynamic is, if you looked at your 100% population, mm-hmm. you see, you know, there's ones that you need to be able to reach that you want in the program.
Right.
If you had 100 people participating, how many of the 100 is that? Is that 5 or 10 or 70? If it's only 5 or 10, and you're pricing it low enough for them, then the other 90 are getting a price that's a lot lower than what it should be to make sure you can accommodate 5 or 10.
Right.
And I think that's Scott's point. We're
not pricing it that way.
Okay.
We're pricing it based on the board's policy of the percentage of recovery. So that's my concern, is that those that can't afford what that board recovery policy requires are left out. So they're not even included in the equation because they're not even in the program.
But in principle, what we're describing wouldn't seem unworkable as long as there were a way to address the exceptions or some kind of a process by which people could apply for a scholarship or tuition assistance or something like that. In principle, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
Right. I guess the principle would be for the board to, you know, make sure that we're recovering the amount that the board would want. And that would, you know, that's the way in the current situation how the price is determined. Are they looking to, how much cost are they looking to recover?
And this would turn that around a bit. You know, we would be frozen to be charge market price and deal with the exceptions, the folks who need the service but can't afford it, as a separate matter. And if you're charging the market price, then presumably there's some additional revenue in the system within the program itself that could be used to help those who couldn't afford it. Just a thought.
Anybody have anything else?
Just could most of those other percentages, you gave the specifics for Claude Moore, but are you pretty much hitting those percentages?
For the summer camp preschool,
yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, we're meeting or exceeding,
okay.
Often exceeding. The rec center, we're still
looking on. Yeah, well, that's one thing I noticed. That I think your fees are kind of, just from some of the goes to different rec centers, they're pretty low. I think they could be higher, and I don't think you'd be chasing people away because to be able to use a facility like Claude Moore for a child 3-7 guy with $5.50 is pretty low, in my opinion. Because I'd pay a lot more than that at facilities that aren't nearly as nice. And compared to like to Fairfax, that also indicates that we're quite a bit lower.
The other thing that is apparent to me, which I'll just comment on, is you are far from an unsophisticated operation. You know, if you look at the range of programs you offer, it's a diverse range of programs. You know, you look at some of your discussion of different pricing strategies with regard to a discount strategy to drive memberships at Claude Moore. That's creative. You talk about your successful birthday celebration program at Claude Moore. You know, there is some evident sophistication to what you're doing. And if you combine that with good program content, it seems to me that you could be quite competitive, in the marketplace. So, well done.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anyone? Anything further? All right. Moving on to next steps. I don't have really an updated outsourcing report or any additions to that, unless anybody has any questions or suggestions for...
What do you want to do with next steps on the fee structure, on the fees? Because this is the first bit of data that we've gotten, right? There's quite a bit more.
That's correct. You'll be... my apologies. We're just running tight. Over the next couple weeks, I'll be rolling out... Similar reports, although probably up to date. Again, this is the most comprehensive item that existed in terms of Parks and Rec. So the rest of the fee information that I provide to you, I'm capturing now, point in time, updated. So I'll be rolling those out for various programs. The one, there is another document that I distributed to you via email, and I warned you not to print it for this reason. I believe Mr. Mays at the last full GRC meeting mentioned this document in terms of cost allocation, so I didn't know if you wanted to entertain any kind of discussion.
I'd like to ask him to give us the summary of what it says, but before we do that, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the discussion we just had on Parks and Recs, I in looking through all the different fees, there's no way, in my view, that we can validate that the rate that's being charged, $30 for the use of the inline hockey rink for non-commercial use, is a good fee or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the question or the feedback for us to give the board is, you guys have to decide philosophically what it is you want from Parks and Recs programs. And I think we could advance the flesh out the hypothesis that we discussed tonight about more market-driven pricing and dealing with special needs from a financial perspective as a separate matter. And if they want to approach it that way, it sounds to me as if the Department of Parks and Recs could approach it that way. They just want to have a tool in place so they can deal with the financial need situations.
Okay.
And I guess, going to these different programs, which seem to be successful in actually generating more revenue than their costs, the ones that were listed here, and I guess they're pricing it to meet the board's directive of a certain percentage.
Right.
I mean, I think we should approach looking at, how much are we charging for those services versus what it would cost to get it in the private sector?
Mm-hmm.
If it's wildly below, then I guess you need to address the board that, are you sticking to those percentages for a particular reason, or do you want to know what you could be charging and still be at or below what these things cost in the private sector.
If it's a market-driven pricing model, the basic mission or directive to Parks and Recs would be price your product to generate the best possible margin for the county, you know, given what you provide to the public. So if they're below market, the prices are going to go up, and there'll be more margin for the county on providing that service.
But I guess these other ones, though, this is board policy, I guess, to be at a certain percentage.
Correct.
So then they would have to change that policy. If you're charging, you're telling staff, okay, you'll generate 115% of the cost for preschool, and you could actually generate 225% based on fair market, mm-hmm. then they're going to have to change that policy.
Yep.
And so that's maybe what we could do is for those particular services show, yes, you're the right number, or you have potential here to be generating significantly more revenue than what we're currently generating.
And I think from what Mrs. Ryerson said, she believes there are certain programs that could generate significantly more revenue. Not all of them, but there are certain programs that could. The caveat is, what do we then do for those residents who can't afford the program? And I think our proposal would be, that's a separate question.
Right.
You know, the program's worth what it's worth. We should charge what it's worth.
But it's a question I think that should be brought as part of this, yes. saying that there should be a mechanism in order to address that issue, to yes. make sure that we aren't keeping kids out that would otherwise be part of the program and simply demonstrably cannot afford it. What can we do to supplement that?
Yes, which I think is another piece we've already talked about with regard to adult daycare. Okay. And we think adult daycare is a needed service. We didn't find, Woody and his research didn't find the private sector provider of the same service, so the county seems to be the provider of last resort. We all agree that the county should be providing it, but it seems to us that there are certain situations where some of the households who are benefiting from the service could pay more, then why shouldn't
right.
they, if they can? So it's kind of a consistent theme, I think, in that regard.
Well, just as another potential approach of voluntary additional payment. So in other words, rather than raising all prices and then asking people to self-identify, I need help, to instead take a similar approach to as Fire and Rescue does of fundraising for additional dollars, but that's seen as a valuable service. Just another thought.
My opinion is that the combined system in some respects illustrates the challenge of that, because people feel like, well, why should I donate? I already pay taxes. Or people are donating and then finding out the tax payments that are paying for it. It's a very confused kind of a message. Please note that I'm not saying anything that's critical of the fine work that volunteers do. I'm simply saying I think that's an example of a confusing situation where it's not clear exactly who's paying for what. And my own experience with asking people to volunteer to pay more if they can is that very few people do. Whereas I think that market-driven pricing tends to be perfect. It arrives exactly where it needs to arrive to attain equilibrium in the marketplace, you know, for the demand and what's being provided, and then you deal with the exceptions on this stuff. So that would be my view of things, but I am an unrepentant capitalist, and I make no bones about it.
And I look at the point of view, if there's a program that I think is a good deal that I'm willing to pay a price for, I'm just going to pay the price. I'm not going to go, hey, how come their kid's paying less than mine? I could kick, you know, it's just not something I'm going to concern myself with. I'm just...
Right. My only thought is that I don't know to what degree people self-identify when they need help.
It might stop some people from even bothering to try. They see, oh, it costs 100 and whatever, and I can only afford 80, so I'm just not even going to bother. Even though it might say, hey, we do have programs available to help people that if they can't afford, they may not even go there, and they just may go, you just may lose them.
Exactly.
And I think was probably one of her concern was that, you know, there are people that should be there, and you might just lose them rather than them make the effort to get that reduced rate. That is a possibility.
And and you know, then you've got also the administration and overhead of having the
somebody to do that program,
the evaluation of who has need, who doesn't have need, et cetera. And does the administration of that overcome whatever savings you might have,
or
additional revenue,
right? And if it turns out some of one of these programs is it's really off skew, I mean, we could be generating significantly more. Then it's like you can build that cost to administer that program as part of this because the price should be significantly higher than what we're charging. If we're right about that number, if our comparison to the private sector is right about the same, probably not going to tinker with it, in my recommendation.
But it's also, sorry.
No, as I say, but if there's one where we're really losing some significant revenue, then it might be worth exploring to put that process in place.
No, I agree. I mean, if we're talking like if our prices are half of what market should be, then I agree there's definitely room to raise our prices to be more competitive. Particularly in those areas where there is an established market.
Yeah.
It also seems to me that that particular function, a financial qualification function, lends itself to being centralized. Because it wouldn't have to be unique to Parks and Recs.
Right.
You know, it could be a centralized function where people are qualified for a certain level of assistance with regard to any relevant program across the county. And some of that already happens, we learned, some of the human services that the county provides. So there's probably a framework there that can be built upon to one degree or another. Although Mr. Hampshire could correct me if I'm wrong.
I think the thing to keep in mind is that local government, as it has evolved, offers a variety of different goods and services. Some of them are 100% public goods, for which either through tradition or board policy, there is no desire to extract a fee. Some are closer to 100% private good, but in the case of child care, historically the county has done it because in many places in the county there literally was no one else to do it. The object lesson in that regard is when AOL built their campus. It is not by chance that there is that kinder care or whatever place right next door. They had to build that themselves in order to have child care nearby. There was just nothing in that area. And that is, in essence, how the county got into that role. But then there are a series of goods that fall somewhere in between the 100% public and the 100% private. And that's where the policymakers have a hard time, often over time, driving at how much of it should be fee supported. We have a program for middle school kids. That's not quite daycare, but it's not quite, it's not really a private goody entirely because there's a huge public purpose in keeping latchkey middle school kids occupied. There's a pretty good public good for that.
Yeah. So, for example, he's talking about the YAS program, which is on attachment 2, page A2-2. It's about midway down the page, the bottom third probably. You see the CASA monthly fee, that is your traditional after-school program for elementary kids. And right underneath it is the YAS program, and you can see a variation in the fee where at one point in time we tried to collect 100%.
Yeah, that was thoroughly unsuccessful.
But enrollment just dropped. Because the direction of the board was to try to collect 100%.
Why was it unsuccessful?
Because the program.
Right, people stopped. Yeah, to kill the program. There was no demand for it at that price. And the board decided that they'd rather have the program to keep those kids somewhat occupied than to have it be fully fee offset. So it's one of those. It wasn't 100% public good or 100% private good, and the board had to estimate what level of fee recovery was sufficient for the public good side of it that they wanted to achieve.
So I think what you run into there is most people with children, they're elementary school aged, they want them somewhere between that time when they get out of school and when mom and dad come home from work, they want them to be somewhere because of their age. What you see at the middle school age, when you reach that, mom and dad say, that's okay if they're on their own for 3 hours, they're 12 years old or they're 13 years old. Problem is you go talk to the sheriff's office and they'll tell you when the huge spike of calls start coming in and the petty crimes going on, it's that time of day when the kids are home and the parents are still at work. And so I think that's what it runs into.
Yes.
Parents don't see a benefit for paying the money to keep their middle school child occupied because they can take care of themselves for 3 hours. So why should I spend the money? So that's a case where, is there public good? Absolutely. Maybe even if we don't recover 100%. The big side, the cost to the sheriff's office and the calls they have to run, there's probably some public good that comes from those children being in those programs.
And that's when policy gets into it, because one can make a strong argument for charging nothing. One can make a strong argument for charging 100%. It's really a philosophical, a political philosophical argument. And we'll just tell you that for the last 10 years, the Board of Supervisors has wrestled with that one in particular more than any other.
Well, you can see in the history where the dollar amount has changed over time.
And the thing is that parents are used to paying for their young children, you know, up through elementary age, but middle school people never paid for a program. It's kind of like, oh, I'm done. You know, I'm finally done paying for childcare. So I think that was really hard for a lot of people to accept, to pay 100% for the middle schoolers.
Now, what we'd hope to do over time would be for a program like that would be that we would be able to slowly increment that to a greater level of fee recovery as the buying public got more used to paying for that particular service, while trying to find ways to get the lower income kids in those programs, because those, other kids that you want off the streets as well. So trying to, but it's a longitudinal issue rather than a current service issue.
But once again, if you sever the cost and value of the program from financial need, then you can address that.
To some extent, but the, you know.
Right, but part of the issue, and I think this is what the board has struggled with, the kids that were getting in trouble aren't necessarily from families that have a financial need.
Middle-class 13-year-olds are just, we've all had them. We've been them. Middle-class 13-year-olds may be as crazy as, you know, anybody else.
So you wouldn't, I wasn't that qualified for financial need.
Right. Well, then, you know, one could make the argument, since we're talking philosophically, that the public good that arises from the program is purely the creation of bad parenting in the first place, so therefore we have to pay for people to save them from their own bad parenting.
Right. An awful lot of what we do in public safety is bad.
No, you're saving me from other people's bad parenting. So I appreciate that.
Anyway. All right. So, but thank you for the comments. So, what do you guys want to do as the next step on this in particular? Wait until we have some more data? Do you want to?
Well, I think we continue as with this. We get the next round of data, talk further, and then maybe when we've achieved all that, we scope with where we want to go. Because I think, I don't even know where to start until I've seen all the data.
Very good. Can we ask Mr. Mays to explain to us the overhead cost allocation?
Sure. The Department of Family Services is a condition for some of the federal grants, and in order to get additional funding, the federal government has a consultant perform every year an indirect cost allocation. So it's federal government because on top of the page there's OMBA-87 cost allocation plan, which for those of us who speak federally, you know, tells us where this comes from.
Office of Management Budget.
Yes. Federal Office of Management Budget. What it attempts to do is to take the largely internal service agencies of the county government and allocate their costs to direct service departments, distributed over the direct service departments. I mean, virtually my entire department. I mean, we laugh and say we're the bureaucrats. I mean, that's what we do. We serve all of the other departments. We very rarely directly serve a specific external client. All of our clients are internal clients, starting with the Board of Supervisors all the way down. And the study identified $66 million worth of internal operations costs, and then allocates that amongst the direct service, you know, allocates those costs amongst the direct service providers. What, out of an overall general fund budget of, say, $400 million that year, 66% of the 66 million of the
not 66%.
Right, 66%. That'd be about, you know, a little less than 20% of the 340 million in direct service cost. So, you know, the point I wanted to make was, if you were, we had a significant discussion at the last general meeting of the GRC about overhead rates and whether you wanted to capture more in the way of overhead rates. In general, overhead outside of the department is probably about another 20% above the direct cost, is what this study tells you. But it does vary by the different department, and in many cases it varies because we've got building costs and, you know, facilities maintenance cost and depreciation built into this as well. But as an overall cost, you know, it's about 20% of direct cost.
Where does depreciation show up?
You got equipment. You got building use allowance, and is the very first category. And the second category is equipment depreciation. If you look on.
All right. So the building use is the depreciation of the building over what? 20 years? 30 years? Where does that
should
come
be? 20 years. Yeah, the building.
All right.
In terms of the methodology for equipment. I
brought additional hard copies of the full study.
I use 7%.
Got on my iPad now. So one of the things we talked about is that the real estate costs are not necessarily reflected in the public sector budget the way we deal with them. But you're essentially picking up the burn down of the original capital expenditure over 20 years, and it's classified under this building use line. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, the four main buildings are depreciated based upon the, that should be the schedule. And then, there's one that it looks like they're using a 40-year schedule. Don't know that I'd have done that. Well, we don't depreciate at that, but I guess that's...
Well, we borrow at 20, but depreciation...
40 or 50 years. And equipment should be based on the life of the equipment.
Should be more so than 10 years.
I think it probably depends on, you know, on the type of equipment involved as well.
Yeah, heavy systems like chillers and boilers and stuff could go out 15 years.
We tend to depreciate most of our other equipment over about a 7-year period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then the only time, because this was something you were asking a lot about, Dan, in the last meeting, was, you know, how are we allocating? We're talking about cost recovery. How are we allocating building use, you know, by way of example, as part of that cost recovery? So essentially, it's being picked up. All the building use is being picked up on that first line item.
No, all of the cost for the internal service departments are being picked up in that.
And if
so, if it's a park facility, no.
And where does that get picked up?
It doesn't at this point. There is no, you know, because. There, we have some facilities such as, let's say, pick any Western Community Center, which was built as a school 50 to 100 years ago. You know, we may have renovated it sometime in the last 10 or 20 years, or we may not. So there can be zero to no cost in regards to those. Or you could be looking at something like the Claude Moore Rec Center, which is only 3 or 4 years old, a little more than that now. That we're actively paying, you know, ongoing debt service for.
But the depreciation on the Claude Moore Rec Center doesn't hit the county's financials anywhere.
It hits the accounting system, absolutely. But it doesn't flow. It is not board policy for that to be taken into consideration in terms of fee recovery. Because you would wind up with widely variant fees for different services if you made them building specific.
Does it hit the Parks and Recs financials, Or is it just a
it's the general
overall
fund.
General,
it's the general
appreciation.
Fund.
It's all one big one.
$400 million general fund. Best of all, we carry on the general fund side the liability for all the school debt. If the schools have the asset of all the buildings. Hmm. Governmental accounting in 2012.
That's not a very good deal for you.
No. But those are the rules.
Schools are technically part of the county government at some level.
Yes. So. A school board has title to those schools. The board of supervisors has title to the debt.
Something that should probably change.
They don't have taxing authority, so that's probably why it's that way.
It is. Right. It's a general, almost all of them are the general obligation of the county. The schools can borrow a little bit, but they only have the money the board gives them.
Right. No one will lend them the AAA rates?
No.
And I'm sorry to be obtuse, but when we talk about the budget, this depreciation isn't part of the budget.
We don't. Depreciation is not part of governmental budgeting, and it's not part of our regular reports of expenditures, revenues, and expenditures. In general governmental budgeting, you use revenues and expenditures. With depreciation, that falls under the expenses side, and that's not GASB. That's not the Governmental Accounting Standard Board.
But the debt.
Well, we carry it in our annual financial report.
And the debt service is part of the annual budget. So
yes.
So essentially, you're picking it up there because you're paying for the building over 20 years.
As you repay
the loan.
We pick it up two ways. We pick it up with the debt service fund for those things that are active. We also pick up the in the capital asset preservation plan. We pick up. The renovation cost for buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There probably really should be about 2.5% of the total value per year. Right, should be about 2.5%. We don't really average that. We probably average about 1%. But that's because a lot of what we have is really very new. I mean, we built 2/3 of the school system in the last 20 years, and we built a lot of the county facilities in the last 20 years. But we average anywhere between 1% and 1.5% in general in the capital asset preservation plan. That fund did not exist prior to the mid-90s, but we began to see the problems that many of our neighbors had because they had not basically created a preventive maintenance budget. DC was, of course, the prime example, but a lot of folks had that same issue. And they had to go out and borrow long-term debt to do it. And the Board of Supervisors at that time said they did not want to borrow long-term debt buildings up. So we, in essence, cash fund on an annual basis. It's about $10 million this year between us and the school system. And that takes care of the most crucial issues. That's everything from paving to roofs. Sometimes, if we're going to replace all the carpeting in a building, windows.
It's a sensible way to do it. Okay, so if you really wanted to try to allocate. So we could basically, as a rule of thumb, say, all right, 20% of the cost of a program is additional overhead, which is represented by this board
mm-hmm.
right here. But that would not capture any of the use of the facility in which the program is located. It only captures those portion of facilities that are used by your group.
We could probably design a rent calculation for the distributed properties based on general services, the square footage of all of the facilities. Come up with a rule of thumb for that. It would be a generalized rent thing. Again, it would not be specific to which are new and which are ancient.
But that could certainly relate back to the ongoing debt service
mm-hmm.
for those that are active. That would be interesting. Do you think that would be interesting and useful?
I haven't seen the Board of Supervisors have much interest in that.
Do you think it would be interesting and useful?
unless it's interesting to the Board of Supervisors, doesn't rank very high on my list right now.
Oh, but I mean, in terms of our discussions, though, if we're looking at pushing program fees either up to market and or up to more effective cost recovery, and especially with the cost recovery percentages that are in there.
A true cost recovery.
Cost recovery, exactly. By not including some of these building costs, we're really leaving a lot of cost. And so even if we were to take like the 120% formula or some of the others that are listed in there by board policy, if we were to apply that to some of these facilities costs in order to get a true cost recovery, that might get us a lot closer to market rates.
If you're looking at daycare service, I guarantee you that every one of those little daycare centers you see around, they're putting in their costs for operating and the construction and the cost to run that building are going into what they're charging. Otherwise, they won't be in business very long.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it would be useful and interesting. I'd love to see it.
As long as there's two standards of accounting, whereas in the civilian world, buildings are worth something, and in the government world, they're not part of the operations budget or something. As long as there's two different sets of accounting, it's going to be hard to reach that equilibrium where something is being delivered for what it costs. Because that's the only place I can find in the world that doesn't figure the cost of a building.
Well, there's lots of different versions of accounting. You ought to see the federal government. I mean, they don't have a capital budget. When an aircraft carrier and a Social Security payment are in essence the same, or a transfer payment are in essence the same thing. It's even though one may be paid off over a much longer period of time. It really is all in the way people structure how they want to see the information.
Right.
Well, I understand what Ben's saying about the federal go to see the federal government. All right, that's different. But we're dealing on a local level, and we're looking at what is to be provided locally. And if it becomes not in line with market-driven prices, then we should reflect on that and bring it up to it. And if it takes, as Dan pointed out, if it takes looking at some of the cost of our structures because it skews the price. We got into this with adult daycare. You know, it skews the cost per person or what have you, so it looks more attractive without that figured in there.
Is there kind of a lazy man's calculation that you could do? Basically say, you know, here's all the square footage we have, and here's the big lump of all of the expenditures that relate to that square footage. So on average, it costs us X amount per square foot.
If forced to do such a thing, that's exactly what I would do, would be the lazy man's approach, I can assure you. And indeed, yeah, I think something like that could be done pretty easily. Yeah, I think general services could be put together for us. Just be an accumulation of a couple of different factors.
Right. But I'd really like to see that because I think that it could factor into, as we're looking at more data, then we could use some for instances and say, so for instance, if you factored in the total square footage of the club, more rec center or whatever.
Well, I would suggest a county-wide average because really and truly that's what...
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
rather than pick on the
rec center...
I understand, but a countywide figure, right?
Right.
We could then take that figure and we could apply it to a particular program for purposes of illustration. To say if you take this as a given, then the program actually is costing X, not Y, and actual true recovery would be
right. Yeah, the reason why we would use a countywide figure just to put it into, I guess, a more specific picture is you want to think about Claude Moore. Claude Moore is a relatively new facility. We provide daycare, for example, out of a portion of that facility. Mm-hmm. We also provide daycare out of centers in Western Loudoun.
That have been paid for decades.
Right. Correct. And so you want to have an average number, not one that's skewed in Eastern Loudoun because of land value.
I buy that.
And so that's one we
recommend. It's basically a rental estimate.
Correct. That's exactly what it would be. Yeah. What our costs would be.
And that combined with the 20% overhead of internal operations, you know, maybe you're looking at another 5%, maybe somewhere, 25-30% total overhead. And that that's what I was really getting to, inarticulately at the last full meeting, was that if you wanted to push towards a more true cost formula, That's one way you can get at that. I mean, again, I will tell you, though, the Board of Supervisors has arrived at almost all of these fee decisions via their own political policy-oriented process. But, you know, that it certainly makes sense for the committee to discuss.
Youth activities are a perfect, youth sports are a perfect example, which, you know, if we were to charge the full price of what it costs, you get an outcry in the boardroom. I mean, that's what happens. But we can certainly generate that number. I mean, that's what Ben means by that remark.
Well, we were a long
time. The board has us to look at. We don't have to like our.
Right.
That's
what I'm saying in a very crude, he said it much more eloquently, but what he's basically saying is there are programs where whatever the board has gone towards trying to do or get closer to full cost recovery, you get an outcry.
But it has changed over time. I mean, it's not right. I mean, Diane can tell you, about 20 years ago when we proposed charging anything close to 100% for adult sports fees, they filled the room with their bats and balls, and they chased the board out, basically. The board wouldn't do it. But over time, we've gone to that.
Closer.
You know, even just 5 or 7 years ago, we weren't charging much, if anything, for some of the youth stuff.
Right.
And we're charging a lot more for it, and we're picking up. So, you know, it's a longitudinal process, as I said.
Anything that where a fee is increased is going to cause the chairing section for, you know, the user section of that to show up and take a very loud approach to the fact that they're being charged, and they're going to show up and do it. And so far, we have not effectively seen a board to be able to sit up there and say, well, there's 100 of you in here tonight, but there's 330,000 more in this county. So we got to think of all of them, not just the cheering section that's here.
Taking that broad brush approach, is that going to include school buildings as well as other county buildings?
We'll have, you know, we probably would look at the school stuff because, I mean, we are paying... We are doing capital asset replacement costs for some of those. But I think we would prorate it on the amount of time we're actually in those buildings. Because those buildings don't exist before. I mean, we would have to get some kind of, if the primary use, and again, at the full committee, there was that discussion of full use of the building versus, you know, partial use of the building. I think we'd have to talk to General Services about some kind of formula based on that.
But in terms of coming up with the rental rate, the per square foot rental rate?
I think it would be based on how much time you're in there, rather than the full building cost themselves. It'd be a fraction of that.
Well, if I'm hearing you right, when we start to put together the cost burden, I agree with you 100% that it makes sense to prorate it in some way. What I'm wondering, though, is, you know, when you talk about the lazy man's approach of taking all of the building costs and divide by all of the square footage, are we talking including all of the school buildings or only looking at the county buildings and deriving that initial rate?
I think we would do all of the county buildings, and I think we would look then at our use, because it's primarily Parks and Rec, the schools, and whether some fraction of that can be done in a similar exercise.
Okay.
Because again, it's really just the elementary schools for the most part.
We use the elementary schools and the middle schools for sports, and very little use of the high schools.
Right.
We couldn't do the programs we do without the schools.
So, but again, you know, they're primarily built for the function than that. But we do build, you know, I will say up front, we build bigger gyms in the elementary schools because we're going to use them for Parks and Rec.
Right.
The gyms are sized for Parks and Rec use, not for an elementary school use. So we'd have to look at how we do that.
Okay. Extremely interesting.
Anything further? All right. Next steps on the other two items. I don't think there's anything to discuss. Julie, never having been to one of these meetings to present before, only as an observer, if it says 5 o'clock, is there usually preliminary stuff that happens, or will we do it right at 5?
No, you would not do it right at 5. There's an agenda for the meeting, which is not firm at this point.
Mm-hmm.
When the agenda's firm and some things they vote on in a block, if you will, called the consent agenda, I would have a little bit better idea of when you would be up. But I'll never be able to give you an exact time.
Is it in...
These meetings typically run 2 hours.
Okay. Is it inappropriate to call Ralph and ask him to be at the top if I had to be somewhere that night? Or is that in poor form? Okay.
Yeah, I think that'd be fine. Okay. I mean, initially we had you scheduled towards the end because you had a
prior
commitment. So
kind of reversed it, and I'm going to do it afterwards, so I could be there at 5. So.
No, I think that'd be fine. We can make that call for you.
Okay.
And then you.
That'd be great. Thank you. All right. Anybody have anything further? All right. Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor.